Okay, thank you for the time. I really appreciate it. So today I'm going to talk about a totally new approach to physics and deriving as many rules as possible in this new picture that we are going to consider. I'm going to start by a quote from Einstein that everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. And that is basically simplicity is what this whole view is based on. So we're going to start with a very, very simple view of the world. So just to begin, I just want to mention a few very important points in this approach. So in this approach, the concepts that we usually take as fundamental, such as space, time, even energy, matter, all those kinds of variables or values are not fundamental in this picture. So instead of taking those as fundamental, we start by a very much more simpler picture, and then we see how much physics we can derive based on this view of the physical reality. And we call this picture influence network, and I just want to make that distinction between the influence network, because there is a difference between the causal network or causal picture and the influence network that we are going to talk about that I will mention later on. All right, again, another nice quote by Bertrand Russell. So the observer, when he seems to himself to be observing a stone, is really a physicist, is to be believed observing the effects of the stone upon himself. And that is basically the whole idea of this influence network. We are going to consider the things influence one another and how we can basically quantify those. All right, so I'm going to start by the basic idea in this picture. We consider that things influence one another in the universe. So this is a very general approach. Entities influence one another, and the act of influence along with the act of being influenced, both are, each of them are called an event. So, so basically here you can say that event X is influencing event Y. And this is an asymmetry relation between the two. Due to that, that actually asymmetry of influence allows us to order events in this way. And you can see that in this way of defining the influence, we can see that the events occur in pairs. So, let's put them very nicely into postulates. So what we just talked about is now here listed as the postulates. So events can influence one another. And then influence is transitive. That means that if we have an event X that influences event Y, and event Y influences event Z, then event X influences event Z. So this influence is transitive. And each instance of influence defines two events, the act of influence and the response to that influence. So therefore, you can see that we have a set of events along with a binary ordering relation, which gives us a partially ordered set of events in this case, or a post set for short.
Question?
Yes.
It looks, given your picture, that the order relation that defines your set is not influence, because this thing is not closed under, like, you know, X influences Y influences Z, but there's no arrow directly from X to Z. So arrows.
No.
So you don't have a transitivity. So is it fair to say that the order relation is defined in terms of, let's call it, direct influence? And when you use the word influence in your postulates, you're talking about either direct or indirect influence. But that's the thing that's transitive. Indirect influence is transitive.
Well, yeah, so this is actually, we can say in this case that this X is also indirectly influencing event Z.
Right, this is just a bit confusing because it would seem natural to think that the order relation is defined by the notion of influence that you just laid down postulates for. But in fact, it's defined in terms of the notion of direct influence for which transitivity does not hold. Is that fair?
It could be a notational convention that you just delete the arrows that that are not necessary. That in fact, there's an arrow between every pair of events. You only keep the arrows. Is that right? Or
Can you say again?
Well, for example, you have y. Then you go along the outside. You go from y along the outside on the left hand side. Yeah, you can go from y to the next. But you could also have a direct arrow from y to those dots further along. But you delete them because from the graphical representation. Is there a reason not to also have an arrow?
No, this is just a random set of events with a relation among them. It is not that this is the only way that it can take place. If I have a set of events with this relation among, influence relation among them, then I can talk about a partially ordered set of events. But in that case, it's not that I can basically take events out and then redraw
what
the arrows.
You could draw an arrow from Y to that dot. Yeah.
I think the argument is just that the graphic does not satisfy the postulates, and we try to understand that. Should we read the arrows as influence or not?
I'm trying to understand the question. So what you're saying is that just because we cannot talk about the transitive events, this influence being transitive because of...
I think the point is your sentence, X influences Z. And that there's no arrow in the graph.
Direct arrow.
But that's
yeah.
fine because
that's fine,
the
yeah.
the influence, so the information is still, if you want to think about it that way, although this is not directly related to Z, it's not that Z does not have any information about that because they are indirectly related. So. But Z definitely cannot have any information about, for example, I don't know if I can find a point in the. So for example, X cannot have any information about this one because there is no influence between them. So directly or indirectly, those are not related. So that is why it's all right. So now, if I have that posted, and as I mentioned, it can be a random set of events with the relation among them. I just happen to just draw this picture. So I can now go ahead. The next step would be how to quantify this partially ordered set. Well, in order to do that, I'm just going to pick a sequence of events that are totally ordered in this partially ordered set. And I'm just going to basically quantify them in the simplest way possible. I'm just going to number them 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm just going to count the events. And therefore, this is and then it's a monotonic valuation. And I assign a real number to each element of the chain. And I'm just going to call this chain an observer. So these are called observers. And this is obviously, as you can see, not the only totally ordered chain that I can talk about in this partially ordered set. I just picked this one. But you can think of different totally ordered sets or observers in this partially ordered set. All right, the next step would be how to quantify the rest of the posted with respect to this with respect to this observer chain. And in order to do that, I first need to talk about the relation between each event and a chain or an observer chain inside a partially ordered set. And these are all the four possible cases that can possibly happen in terms of the relationship between an event and an observer chain. So for example, if you consider this case, here an event X is being influenced by one of the events on this observer chain called P bar of X. And therefore, it can be actually related to that through a backward projection. I'm going to consider a backward projection, and then the valuation that is actually given to this element on this chain would be considered to quantify that partially, not totally. In this case, there is an event on the chain, observer chain, that is being influenced by event X. Therefore, event X can be mapped through a forward projection onto that element on the chain. Here, both of the forward and backward projections exist. And here, there is no relation between the X or any of the events on the chain. Observer chain P. Now, in order to quantify, to be able to quantify an event with respect to an observer, this is the case that we consider where both the forward and backward projections exist. Now, let's see how that looks. So in our original partially ordered set, if you, for example, take a look at this event here, you can see that there is a backward projection from that event onto chain, our observer chain. And then there's a forward projection. So the two elements that are used in order to quantify that event are basically the forward projection and the backward projection numbers. So that would be the pair that is used to quantify that event.
You can just say the least upper bound among all the forward projections, the greatest lower bound among all the backward.
Yes. So if I wanted to, I should have said that here. So for example, if there is an element P bar X that influences event X, then obviously all of the lower elements on this chain would also influence event X. But in order to quantify this event X with respect to this chain, I take the least, the greatest element that can influence this event on the chain and the least element that is actually being influenced by this event X, the valuation of those two in order to quantify this event. And then you can see that I can go ahead and quantify as many events as possible, but for example, this event or this one, well, there is no element on this chain that can be influenced by this event. So therefore, I cannot quantify that event. Or the same case in here and all of those other cases that you see the dot, which means that I cannot quantify that event with respect to this chain. And obviously, if I pick another chain of events or another observer chain, then the numbering would change, and obviously the quantifying pairs would change as well. So this is not unique. It totally depends on the choice of observer chain. All right, so let's see how we can actually, what we can get out of this ordering relation by just following the order in projections. All right, so the first thing that we need, remember, we are just talking about a set of events and just the relation between them. So these are not, we do not have any space or time. We're not talking about any of those things. So in order to be able to talk about collinearity and directionality, we have to define them and see what they mean in this picture. So for example, an element X is said to be properly collinear. So if this element X is properly collinear with these two chains P and Q, if the projection of element X onto one of these chains is first found on the other one, for both forward and backward projection, what that means is that if I'm going to follow the projection of X onto chain Q, I have to first look at I see the projection, I find the projection first on chain P for both the forward and backward projection. So therefore, in that case, I will say that element X is collinear with these two chains. And this is true for all of these other cases. By just interchanging the chains P and Q, you get the same actually condition. Now, if this case happens, then I say X is to the left of the two chains, P and Q. And this is the case where X is between the two chains. And this is the case where X is on the right side of the two chains. Now, again, I just want to specify that these are very nice and straight pictures, but that doesn't mean that I have these elements in space to the right side or left side of these chains. This is just following the projection. So if I follow the projection and I find the projection of this guy for both the forward and backward onto this chain is first found on that chain, then I know that it's to the, for example, left of the two chains, and it's collinear with those two, and so on for the rest of them. So that's the condition. Yes?
Nice question. How do you know that there aren't more possibilities? So the middle case would be something like, you know that projecting X onto Q gives you the same thing as if you project X onto P bar and
then backward,
Q.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the other case is if I project X onto P, it's the same as projecting onto Q bar onto P. Couldn't it be that, it's Q in both cases? That I can find that if I project X onto P, I get the same thing as if I project X onto Q and then onto P, and if I project X onto P bar, it's the same as if I project X onto Q and then P bar. So rather than having Q and Q bar associated with P and P bar relative to, in all the possible ways, couldn't it be sort of just a unique association on the Q side? You've kind of embedded it into normal geometry, so it seems like
Yeah. These
are the relevant cases, but if we're doing it abstractly,
but
I'm wondering what rules out that other possibility.
Well, actually, basically, it's I put that in between those so that it's easier to actually visualize. But you can have that actually outside, as long as on either way, as long as the first, for example, in the betweenness, in the case that where X is between the two, the forward projection onto one should be equal to the forward, the first backward projection onto the other, and then forward projection to the first one. So it doesn't necessarily have to be on that side or between the two chains. It can be, I'm just following the projections of that event onto these two chains. So if either of, and it turns out that these are the only possible cases for betweenness and being on the left-hand side and right-hand side. And we actually show that all of the other cases are ruled out. So this is basically all of the cases that can happen in order for an event and two chains to be collinear.
By assumption, P and Q do not intersect.
Are P and Q are? I didn't.
Not intersect.
No, P and Q do not share an element.
But it can be not possible to embed them in two dimensions, right? They can live in higher.
I'm not talking about any dimensionality yet.
So
it's not in space. It's just following the projections, the order in projection. All right, so collinearity allows the chains to be ordered. I can order the chains, and I can say which a chain is by just following this collinearity condition. Another condition that we can talk about is the subspace. So if X is properly collinear with two distinct chains, P and Q, then the elements of the discrete subspace are defined by the two chains, and I show that by this notation. Well, again, you can see that this is the same case as we talked about in the collinearity condition. So if I can, if the forward projection of X onto Q is the same as the first backward projection onto P and then forward projection onto Q for both of them, so I can actually follow the projection path it's going to be the same as going backwards, and I mean backward projection and then forward projection in this case. Whereas in here, well, X does not belong to the subspace that is formed by P and Q, because look at the forward projection. If you follow the if X wants to first be backward projection, backward projected onto P and then forward projected onto Q, it's not the same as so these two paths are not the same. So here X does not belong in the subspace formed by PQ, whereas here it does. So we can actually define subspaces in this way. All right. So let's see if we can have some metric in this quantification of the poset. So we've been talking about just a single event being quantified by an observer chain. Now let's see if we have a pair of events, which we call intervals, how can they be quantified? So in this case, if you look at this red interval, it's defined by a pair of chains. And you can actually quantify this interval by either four numbers here. Basically, this is quantified by the pair 3 and 3 because it's on the chain. And then I can actually rewrite the first two elements of the quantifying pair and the second two elements of the quantifying pair. Therefore, this four-tuple can be used to quantify this interval. I can also quantify the interval by just taking the difference between the first two elements and the second two elements. And therefore, I can quantify the interval by a pair of numbers. Or I all of these are actually proven through theorems, I can actually quantify this interval by just the multiplication of the two elements of the pair. And in this case, it's going to be a scalar, which is equal to minus 2. And if I get a scalar equal to a negative value, then this is called an anti-chain lock interval. And I can also take a look at another case in this case. And if the scalar would be equal to 0, which means at least one of these elements is equal to 0, then I will get the projection-like interval. And for an element along the chain, for which I get the positive number for the scalar, I will get a chain-like interval. So these are the three possible cases of the different intervals that I can have.
But the value, if the chain in that particular example, the value was equal to 1, does that mean there's only one step between those two?
In this case, yes, because as you can see, it's just one step between.
If there were two steps, would the scalar be equal to 2?
It would be. As long as it's along this chain.
As long as that chain.
Yeah.
Okay. But if it's along a different chain?
It can be it depends on which, again, if it's along any chain, it depends on how many steps are in between those
that's,
two.
And that's,
yeah.
And this scalar is independent of which chain you use to.
This scalar is basically we will talk about that, how it will stay invariant. Yeah. All right. So now what about,
So some points don't have a well-defined number because the chain is finite. Like the first number in the tuple is not well-defined because the chain is finite. And you could complete that and at least talk about intervals of a region in the center, around the center of the chain, let's say. But still, are the numbers unique? Are you kind of
no? Of course, it depends on the choice of your observer chain. Yeah.
No, not only that, but given the observer chain, are the labelings of the nodes unique?
I just said that I'm going to basically use the simplest case possible. I'm just going to count them. Monotonic valuation 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah,
so,
no, but the labels of all the rest of the nodes. They are unique?
Yes. So you, I think it boils down to you find the least upper bound and the greatest lower bound, and those are uniquely defined.
Yeah.
But you could have 2 points with the same.
Yeah, there's an example where you have.
Oh,
two
yeah, indeed, they are not unique. Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean like it's a given labeling?
Indeed, okay.
So I had a question, which is how do you define the intervals for those points where some
that we cannot, we cannot quantify those. If there is not a pair to quantify those events, then I cannot quantify the interval that is made by those. Okay, so what if instead of just one chain, things get more interesting if I talk about a pair of chains? And that is what I, it turns out that that's what I need in order to be able to define, to find a metric. So if I have two chains, I need a condition that basically allows the two chains to compare information and measurements. So what I'm gonna, the condition on that is the coordination. So the these two chains, P and Q, are coordinated over a finite range if any closed interval, so for example, this can be thought of as a closed interval. So any closed interval on one projects, forward projects and backward projects onto an interval of the same length on the other chain. And it actually has to remain, this condition has to hold for a finite range. And therefore, in this case, this delta P would be equal to delta Q would be equal to delta Q bar. And that is the condition that we have to have in order for two chains to be coordinated. Okay, so if I have a set of coordinated chains, then I'm going to use the coordination condition, and then I'm going to define this. You can kind of think about how this is very easy to write. Well, remember, this delta P would be equal to delta Q, so I might as well write it as delta P plus delta Q divided by 2. And I'm going to call this the length along interval. I can also talk about the distance between the two coordinated chains. So I'm going to talk about the relationship between the two chains. And this relation, I'm going to call this the distance. And it turns out that this is given by this relation, delta P minus delta Q over 2. So this is what you see in here, and it should be independent of the choice of the event. So, for example, if you think about, in this case, AB, then you would have 2 plus 2 divided by 2, and then in this case, you would also have 3 plus 1 divided by 2. So both of them would give you the same relationship between the two chains. All right, so now I'm going to talk about an interval quantified by a pair of coordinated chains. So this is just some general interval. It doesn't have to be in the chains. So in a very general case, this interval is going to be quantified by these two elements, delta P and delta Q, by these two coordinated chains, P and Q. And I can rewrite this delta P, delta Q. If you add up the first two elements of the pair and the second two elements, you will actually see that that is equal to delta P plus delta Q. However, if you take a close look, you will see that I've actually used the length and the distance between the two chains in here, which I'm going to talk about shortly. All right. If you consider the same interval, so if this is basically some interval, I can actually consistently quantify that interval by a scalar. And that would be, through a theorem, we prove that this is actually given by the multiplication of the two elements of the quantifying pair, or in terms of the length and distance along the chain, we actually can rewrite that in terms of delta P plus delta Q divided by 2 squared minus this term. And therefore, if you, all right, so I first have to, those two slides are, should be reversed in the order. All right, so I'm going to rewrite this delta T in terms of delta P plus delta Q divided by 2 and delta X. I'm going to just call these. These are just renaming those two values that I had. Therefore, I can rewrite my scalar in this term, in this form. And then if I substitute these two values, I actually get the Minkowski metric, without the notion of space or time. Remember, I never mentioned anything about space or time. These are just relabeling these values that represent the distance and length on the chains, between the two coordinated chains. So I can, that way I can basically have the metric. All right, we keep getting things more interesting by just adding another pair of chains. So if I have another pair of chains, so initially I had these two chains and then an interval in between that these two could quantify. Now, if I have another set of chains and they all want to quantify the same interval, I just want to see how they can compare their quantifications. And again, we prove that if one interval on either of these two coordinated chains is projected onto these two coordinated chains. Remember, PQ are coordinated, P prime and Q prime are also coordinated, but they are not coordinated with each other. So PQ is not coordinated with P prime and Q prime. So I just want to find the relation between the two. And therefore, if an interval of length K projects onto an interval of length M on P prime and of length N on Q prime, then it turns out that the relation between the two quantification pairs is given by this relation, by this equation. And you can basically rewrite delta P prime delta Q prime in terms of delta P delta Q, and if you solve for I don't know why the order has changed. Yeah. So basically, what you if you want to rewrite these two in terms of one another, and you solve for delta p delta q in terms of delta t prime and delta x prime, this gives you the Lorentz transformation where your beta is basically m minus n over m plus n, and your gamma is given by this value. So what we have in here is simply just, you can see that this is what you can think about it in terms of the speed. Of course, nothing is moving. It's just a relation between these quantification, these intervals. And but still, you will have a lower value and maximum value. So the minimum value you can have zero. When m is equal to n, nothing is moving. And then if, for example, n is equal to zero, then you would get the speed of light, which means one of them is just moving at the speed of light, if you want to think about it that way. All right, so now we can, all right, so we talked about this metric, and we talked about how we can quantify these different intervals and events with respect to coordinated chains. But we need to see what's the geometrical relationship in this whole picture, because, like I said, we do not have anything like a space or time. Although we have the metric, we still need to see what actually we can see in terms of the projections and the events and the coordinated chains. So what we have in here is that we can have, if we have three coordinated chains, these two are two different cases of coordinated chains. For one, you will see that the projection, for example, onto y, onto z is first found onto y. And for all of these, you can basically construct this kind of, you can have this kind of projection, whereas in here, you can have another form of projection. And therefore, if you want to take a look at the interval in here that is quantified by these two chains, P and Q, you will get an anti-chain-like interval like that. You can go ahead and quantify the rest of these basically intervals like yz and xz in both cases. And you will see that the only difference is that your XZ interval in here is quantified by 2 delta and minus 2 delta, whereas in here you still get the same thing. And this basically shows that the relation between the three events, the arrangement or the configuration looks like that, whereas in here they are perfectly collinear. The chains are collinear. So by just looking at the different projection and the quantifying those, you can see whether your chains are collinear or they are not. You can imagine that I can add more chains into this picture and keep on quantifying, and I can add dimensions. So you can basically, this could lead to n plus one dimensions. So here's another example. If I add one more chain, and I can go ahead and write down the different intervals in here, x, y, y, z, z, u, and all of the rest, as well as in here. And I will see that this basically shows the case of the collinear chains, all four of them. Whereas in here, you can see that this is what I have, and it's just one more dimension. I can also talk about orthogonality. This motivates the concept of orthogonality. This is a condition that if holds, we can think of two pairs of chains to be orthogonal. So basically, if we take a look at this interval PQ, and if this interval on these two chains, PQ, forward and backward projects onto the pair of chains R and S onto the same point, both for the forward and backward projections, then and then it's actually quantified by the pair 0, 0 with respect to chain PQ, then basically we can think about, and the same thing holds for this other interval R S, then we can think of these two to be this could be the special case that motivates the concept of orthogonality, and we can think about it that way in terms of these two anti-chain-like intervals. It turns out that we also have we can have the Pythagorean theorem for this kind of configuration. So in this case, each of these dots represent a chain, and you're looking actually at the geometric view or aerial view of the orthogonal, basically anti-chain-like intervals. So if we have this configuration of chains, we again prove that you can rewrite this in interval and that interval as the relation between these intervals as delta A squared plus delta B squared equals delta C squared. And that basically gives you the Pythagorean theorem. Again, I'm just including a very small portion of each of these, but each of these results are derived, and we have to prove theorems and then derivations to show these. Again, none of these are just based on assumptions. Again, here we have another. So as you can see, step by step, we have to derive all of the geometric concepts that we actually use, and it turns out that many of them may not be fundamental. So, for example, we cannot just think about the direction and dimension as something that is fundamental to the type of space and time that we choose, because we do not have that, and we have to think about those in terms of our projections and see what actually leads us to that. In this case, we had to we derived the dot product version for the influence picture. And if you want to look at an interval xy and you want to find the projection of that interval onto a set of chains, for example, these can be a set of chains. Again, you're looking at the aerial view. Then you consider the quantification or the distance between this x and each of these chains and Y with both P and Q. And it turns out that the dot product actually is given by this relation for the influence picture. And it doesn't matter whether you pick PQ to find the projection of this XY onto this set of chains, or you pick another set of chains like P prime and Q prime, you still get the same result. So, and again, we derive this relation.
Dot product between what and what?
The dot product between XY and then this is the aerial view of between the, for example, PQ chains, two coordinated chains, P and Q. And then you can have a other...
The dot product between, so to speak, the vector from x to y and some other vector which is from p to
q.
Yep. Or p prime to q prime?
Or p prime to q prime. It doesn't matter as long as this also belongs in the set in here, in the subspace in here. You can. It doesn't depend on the choice of the chains. You still get the same result.
What if you wanted the dot product between two different pairs, x, y, and x prime, y prime?
And where would x prime, y prime be?
I don't know. X might equal x prime, and y prime would be a different element.
These
are sort of distant vectors, right? X, y is not even in the same location as PQ.
No. What do you mean, the same location?
Well, if I thought, well, so far everything you've been doing is, in a sense, aiming at a Minkowski space or a flat space time. So
yeah.
Then you can take a dot product distant vectors, but if you're in a curved space, then it only, dot product only really makes sense in the same tangent space.
So,
so that's what I meant by distant.
So first, again, I'm not talking about any type of space because we do not have the space. I'm just talking about how this X is quantified, for example, with respect to these two chains, P and Q. So I don't know, these are not happening in space, or there is no space or time. It's just...
But I understand that.
But then also for the curved, we haven't talked about any other metrics other than the Minkowski yet, so.
But this basically is giving you a dot product between an arbitrary pair, x, y, and a pair that lies on one of your...
It's arbitrary, x, y is arbitrary, yeah.
X, y is arbitrary, but p and q have to lie on one of your special chains?
So P is actually an aerial view of a chain. So here is my
chain.
Yeah, it's a whole chain. And then that is also, Q is also another chain. So I'm just, as long as they are also collinear, I can talk about the dot product and the projection of XY onto this collinear set of chains. All right, here I just want to mention very briefly what has also been done in the quantum picture. And this is the work that has been done by my former advisor and Professor Knuth, mainly, and I wish to do some more work in this area after I'm done with the geometry part. Very, very briefly, and I'm just mentioning one of the results in that picture, in the quantum picture. The free particle, in the quantum picture, we model the free particle as a particle that only influences and is not influenced. So as you can see, it's just influencing P and Q. And of course, it's an ideal picture, and it enables us to basically have a simpler picture in order to see what concepts we can derive. It turns out that in order to see how these P's and Q's that are basically these events on P and Q that are the result of the influence by this particle on these two chains are ordered with respect to one another. There is no way that you can do that other than just considering all of the possible paths that actually could have caused these sorts of influence on the two chains of P and Q. And if we consider this, then this is actually, we show that this is the similar picture to the Feynman checkerboard problem, which actually is known to lead to the Dirac equation. And basically, this is the picture that we are modeling the quantum mechanics. We are starting quantum mechanics on. And as you can see, it's just the work in progress. And this is, we started from the very simple case. We don't know yet how a particle that is also being influenced and is not a free particle anymore would look like in this picture in terms of the influences and the basically the relations. So what we did is that we took just a very simple theory that is based on the idea that things influence one another, and it happens in a transitive fashion. And that basically gives rise to the Minkowski metric, Lorentz transformation, and some of the geometric features such as dimensionality, subspaces, geometric simplices, and the Pythagorean theorem. We did this by just distinguishing a chain of events which is totally ordered from a partially ordered set, and then quantify as the partially ordered set with respect to that chain. And the posted events are quantified by chain projections with the concept of consistent quantification. So that's what we try to do. And this is basically based on the symmetries. And more recently, we've been able to show that the geometric formalism of the influence network is similar to the geometric algebra. I showed you how we derived the dot product version for this picture, and in the attempt to, in order to derive the cross product, that's where we are actually getting the geometric algebra. And this is currently being done, and it's a work in progress. So that's why I did not present those results in here. But basically, this is it's almost done, and we hope that we get the results very soon. So thank you for your time.
Questions?
Yes.
What would happen if you labeled the vertices along one of those chains, rather than using integers, just use some other increasing numbers? How would that affect like Lorentz transformations and things like this?
Is it
crucial that you use integers?
Do you mean that instead of just numbering them one, two, three, four?
You choose some other increasing set of numbers?
As long as you're consistently quantifying. And if you remember, I first used the real numbers for counting, but then I actually referred to them as just some P and Q. So as long as you're consistent with your quantification, it doesn't matter that you choose 1, 2, 3, 4, I guess.
And then this scalar product you associate with intervals, you had some statement about it being invariant as you change to different.
What about
if you change your labeling along the paths? You keep the same paths for the corpus system, but you just change the numbers along those. Would it change the scalar?
No, so it won't. Yes, exactly. That won't change.
Okay. I don't understand that because there was a case, you gave an example where the scalar was equal to 1 in one of the three examples. So it's a long way back, but
The
last one, the interval is equal to 1, the green one.
Yes.
If I set different numbers, maybe those numbers are just even numbers, so 2, 4, 6, 8, so on. then would the interval be equal to 2 in that case?
If you wanted to quantify everything with starting instead of 1, 2, 3, 2, 4, 6.
Yeah.
So in that case, that your unit would be still, that actually indicates that, for example, because this is just a, an interval between two consecutive events,
yeah.
The length for that is just, the scalar for that is just equal to the unit along this chain.
So,
your unit would be 2 then,
okay.
Yes.
But then you're saying if it was 1, 2, 5, 6, 9, 11 or something, then it would be, you'd get different numbers. I think that's what you would.
Well, you...
if it wasn't just a simple multiple.
I don't think that there would that would actually cause any problem. I mean, you would get a different scalar if like I said, instead of changing that by unit 1, you change it by some multiples. But as long as you were consistent, then that wouldn't affect the total approach.
Could you still define a transformation law between pairs of paths? Where you have just,
so
where you have different, you can still do that?
You can still, like I said, you have to just be consistent with your evaluations. So, but yeah, you should be able to do that still.
Sorry.
Yes.
I came late, so you might have covered this, but you talk about everything is, or most everything was referred to an observer chain.
Yes.
Now, when you say chain, does it mean what people sometimes call maximal chain? In other words, are you allowed to jump over elements? In other words, could I define my... Let's look at that. You have a particular observer chain.
Yes.
Suppose it, which is in your labeling as element 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah.
Suppose I said I want my observer chain to be element 1, 3, 4, 5, you know, leaving out 2. Would you regard that as a valid observer chain?
If I want to evaluate, the evaluation, so the condition for evaluation that I, the condition for the evaluation for the chain is that I'm going to basically give, I'm going to, let's see if I have it here, yes. So I'm just going to quantify this chain by monotonic valuation.
No, I'm not worried about the number. It's not the same as Lucien's question. I'm just saying, actually, omit the point that you've labeled 2.
Mm-hmm.
Omit that from the chain altogether. So your observer chain, just instead of consisting of 5 elements,
mm-hmm.
it would consist of only 4 elements. Would you regard that as a valid observer chain?
It's up to you which set of ordered events you pick. It's not that you have to stick with this observer chain, but I don't quite understand why an event would just vanish from the chain.
You would just choose to leave it out. Why would you choose to leave it out? Because it might be that if you included it, it wouldn't satisfy your condition of collinearity, or I forget what you called it.
So
but there might be, you might have 2 chains which don't satisfy the condition
mm-hmm.
of collinearity, but appropriately selected subsets of that would.
So I'm talking about finite ranges on chains. So I'm not
yes.
talking about infinite.
I'm talking about
yes. And then you can still, so it's up to you which chain, observer chain you pick in this partially ordered set. I chose this one. You might want to choose this one.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, how would you call it, winnowing out or diluting the chain or something, just leaving out certain elements. The reason I'm asking this is that mm-hmm. it depends where you got your poset, your causal set, if you want to call it that. One way you can get one is to start with the space-time and sprinkle points into it and then get the induced order relation. That's those of us working in causal sets.
Yes.
That's the kind of relationship between the continuum and the causal set that we usually have in mind. These are sort of randomly chosen elements. within a space-time. If you do that, it seems to me it's unlikely you'll get to equilibrium.
Yeah.
However, if you make special selections, maybe it's more like, that's why I'm asking.
So
you would have something that didn't include in the chain every element that you might have been able to include.
That is right. So right at the beginning, I just mentioned that I'm not talking about, so this is different from the usual causal picture that is considered. That's why I called it influence network. So in this network, we do not have things that are in space.
Right, but
in
causal space set, time. We don't have things in space-time either. But the question is, in what context or in what sense can a given causal set be approximated by a given space-time? You're actually basically showing us how to build up a Minkowski space-time.
Yes.
From a causal set together with a choice of reference chain, observer
yes.
chain. But in reality, we don't live in Minkowski space. We live in a curved space-time. So you might ask, in what sense can we recover the kind of space-time we really live in? And when you start asking yourself that kind of question, you have to come up with some criterion for when a given space-time and a given causal set are to be regarded as approximately the same.
Okay.
And I'm trying to see what you're doing in light of that question. Okay.
Yeah, so I...
And in light of that question, then it suggests to me this other question that if you took, you didn't tell us dynamically where this closet comes from, but presumably the ultimate aim would be to have some physical laws that will generate the closet itself. Right? You don't just pick any random closet, it needs some dynamics. And then the question is, would you be able to get a Minkowski space out of it? And I'm suggesting that you have a better shot at it using your tools if you allow some of these observer chains to skip over elements. In other words, to omit certain elements that you could have included because they're still a chain. It's still totally ordered.
What we have been considering for the partially ordered set is not any dynamic or changing partially ordered set. So we just take one set and then we talk about that. So I'm not talking about anything that might be changing over time or because we do not have that notion in this picture. But if you're referring to how we can actually generalize that to the, for example, something more similar to general relativity, that's something that we have been thinking of. So we are not there yet, definitely not there.
But so your answer to Raphael's initial question is still a yes, that if you choose 1, 3, 4, 5, this is a completely valid set of ordered events that one can choose.
It's still
you can still.
So that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I don't think anything could go wrong with what
it's not as long as
I was just wondering if in your mind I think we agree. Then I mean you agree on that. And then that's really the whole question, if you like. But I was wondering if in your mind you regarded that as an important possibility or you tended to limit yourself to these maximal chains. The ones which cannot add anything and remain totally ordered.
Yeah. Like I said, it's the same thing as considering. I mean, it's, as long as you're consistent.
This one is not maximal, right?
This one is not?
No.
Well, what could we have added?
I mean, you have like other points which you could add.
Where would you put them?
Between 2 and 3.
For example, you have two choices between 2 and 3.
Oh, but that... I see, you're right, yes. In this case, it's not.
Oh, yeah. You could delete 2 and 3. So you could delete the line between 2 and 3. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Right. So that proves it.
Okay. So.
It's a different kind of question. The kind of space and time you have emerging here are discrete.
Yes.
And so you've shown that you can nonetheless have a notion of essentially two different frames of reference relative to which you could describe the same interval. And you can show that the relationship between the description of that interval and those two frames is essentially a Lorentz transformation.
Yeah.
And that reminds me of a different setting. So I would say in lots of different approaches to physics, people have taken the idea that maybe space and time are somehow discrete, not formalized it in this kind of way,
yeah,
but in a very different sort of way, and then asked the question, to what extent could I obtain the phenomenology of special relativity when I don't have continuous space and time? So one example that comes to mind is Stephen Wolfram's cellular automata approach. And I have only a vague recollection, but it seems to me he also derives the, you know, finds a way of defining frames of reference within a cellular automata such that you recover the Lorentz transformations. And presumably there's other examples of this. And I guess my question is, just to what extent is it the sort of same mathematics, you know, across the board? There's all, I think there's probably more than two examples. I suspect there are many such examples where we get Lorentz transformations when we have discrete space and time. And I'm just curious whether it could be the same mathematical tricks in all cases that allow us to do that.
So the whole thing in this picture is discrete. And like we talked about, it's one of the difficulties in this picture that we just have to think about, do all of these calculations in a discrete fashion, which is much more difficult than the continuous. But I didn't quite understand your question. Do you mean that are there any other, other than the Minkowski metric and the Lorentz transformation, are there other things that are done, calculated in...
But maybe it's more of a comment than a question, because I presume you're not familiar with Stephen Wolfram's derivation of Lorentz transformations in the cellular automata. But the comment would be, if you went and looked how, in the context of cellular automata, people derive Lorentz transformations, it seems likely to me that there'll be a mathematical connection. So perhaps, for instance, you could say, all right, here's a cellular automata. Now let's figure out what causally influences what in that cellular automata. And now let's use our approach to define intervals. And oh, it's exactly the same definition that the cellular automata people were using all along without the language of causal influence. It's just they had found a way of representing Lorentz transformations in the language of their cellular automata. But I'm just kind of curious whether there's a kind of mathematical similarity between the various derivations of Lorentz structure from discrete space.
There is definitely, this is, so I've seen other discrete derivations of Lorentz transformation, like you said, for the special relativity. But and they are approaching, they are not actually, basically not totally forgetting about the space or time or anything, but the formalism is just discrete and they derive the same thing. You're right. So there might be something that we can now go back and think in terms of the causal structure that they use. So this is not the only discrete derivation of the Lorentz transformation. And I've seen a few already within the space-time framework.
So in the causal set approach that Raphael Sorkin and his co-workers used, it, if I'm not mistaken, there's a notion that perhaps we can use the causal relations of a given event, all other events, as a way of individuating events. So which event am I talking about? Well, I don't have a background manifold to say, oh, the event at this location. But I can say, oh, it's the event that's causally related to other events in this particular way. But if a given event is causally related to other events in sort of a way that need not be unique, then you have a problem. So in that very original picture that you showed with the pairs of numbers for...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so in response to Gemma's question, we noticed that the 5-3 node there's two nodes in your diagram that are labeled 5, 3.
Yeah, it's not unique. So,
it's not the case that, you know, for such a graph relative to that choice of chain, I cannot tell you which event I'm talking about by just giving you its coordinates, because it's not unique.
No.
But perhaps you might find it appealing to find a way of describing the events such that the description is unique. Every event has a unique description.
So one of the reasons for considering a pair of coordinated chains was to basically have a more a rigorous constraint on the quantification pair, because if I now can talk about the, for example, the events that are quantified with a pair of chains rather than just one chain, that is a more strong constraint, which also leads to other conditions like the collinearity and other stuff. But like, for example, I cannot talk about the collinearity between one chain and one event. So that has a more strong constraint on the quantification. But still, if with respect to two quantifying chains, if you're talking about one interval or one event, even that you want to quantify with respect to those two chains, unless two events are the same, you won't be able to quantify them with two different pairs with respect to two chains. So,
are you saying that if I use two chains to label my events, the labelings will be unique?
With respect to those two chains, if I have an event and I want to quantify that event with respect to a pair of coordinated chains, then I get, for example, a pair equal to P and Q. If I get another, or delta P, delta Q, if I get another event that is quantified by the exact same pair, then there is no difference between these two events. So there is no way to distinguish between them. So there's no way to tell whether...
No way to distinguish with respect to those two observer chains.
Yes.
But if you added a third observer chain...
Yes, exactly. So
then you might be able to...
So that's why I'm saying adding the observer... Exactly. So adding the observer actually causes a bigger constraint than you would... And then if you add another... So for example, you might not be able to... distinguish between, for example, an interval with respect to one chain. So if they both project onto the same point, but I don't know if we have an example in here that I can show. I don't think so. But if, for example, those two are chain-like and they both project onto the same point on a chain, if you add another, there's no way for this chain to distinguish between these two events. So it just quantifies, it doesn't see the difference between them. But if I add another chain, then these two are projected onto two different points on this other chain. Therefore, they can be distinguished with a pair of chains. So in that sense, that actually somehow, to some extent, solves the problem for...
I would say it maybe lessens the problem. I think what you're saying is the more chains you add, the easier it is to uniquely identify events.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that, you know, any finite number of chains is necessarily sufficient. That, you know, for any number of chains you take, I could probably write down a graph where there's some pair of events that are both labeled the same way
across
those chains. So I guess my comment is that if the ontology of your theory is just there are events and there are causal influences between them, then it would be very nice to be able to say, oh, you know, which event am I talking about? Oh, it's the event that, you know, has two other events that are caused by it, and one of those has a chain that's 5 units long, and the other one has bifurcates and does this, and that's a unique description of an event in the graph. So if you somehow had a principle that said we will only consider graphs relative to which we have descriptions of events that are unique, it seems like a more reasonable ontology than graphs where, you know, there would be two events that are related to all other events in exactly the same way.
But I just wonder if your attitude is slightly different than the one that's been assumed. That is your attitude that these are kind of like observers?
Yes.
And that they have, they experience influences, and they can exert influences and experience influences along these different chains. And you're asking about you're asking questions relative to observers.
So
if there are events that can't be discriminated, that's true relative to some particular set of observers. Is that your attitude here?
So exactly. And then we don't need to be able to distinguish between every single event in order to actually come up with the metric and then the, all of the other
so
derivation that we have.
In some ways, it's a more operational attitude.
Yes.
Wait, now I'm confused by your answer to.
Well, there was a free particle at the end. Remember?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I know
this.
A free particle. That was a pretty primitive observer.
That was more primitive.
Yeah. So I think you from your talk, it seems like you want this framework to apply both to macroscopic things and to microscopic things.
But with the slightly different condition on the microscopic, so which I did not talk about because this is.
I don't think the scope is limited to observers. You really wanted to apply this to individual electrons and say that this is all there is to say about an electron. It's got a bunch of events and there's influences and.
Yes.
Yeah, am I right about that? That ultimately the picture
ultimately,
will be a whole bunch of particles and the influences between them.
Yes,
and
how they influence each other should be able. And how we quantify those should be able to give us all of the information that we want to know about that. Yes, ultimately.
Let me translate Rob's question. I mean, give an abstract answer to Rob's question. Of course, it is an attractive idea that the causal relations, or whatever you call them, influence relations, should totally individuate the points. That's really the elements of this object, this structure. And the abstract criterion for that is that it should admit no automorphism, no non-trivial automorphism. So I think what you're asking is, do we want to make it a principle that this object should admit no automorphisms? And then that's something to be thought about. It's hard to see how you would incorporate it in a dynamical law exactly, but it certainly is something. It's appealing that many people have played with that idea.
Lee Small and Julian Barber proposed a model that took that as a principle. It seems natural given the ontology that you're positive, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Probably David Finkelstein and probably Ted Jacobson. Many people have thought along those lines. But then I think what you're raising is, suppose that it is, I mean, if it really has automorphisms, then there are some elements that cannot, that by any means, observers or whatever, be distinguished uniquely from each other. But then suppose it does, suppose it has no non-trivial automorphisms, then what's a convenient, more concrete way, and then are these observer chains a good way of doing so?
Yeah.
How many observer chains would you need? And so on like that. So I'm just trying to put this question in a kind of context.
If
I think it's consistent with...
If you're restricted to graphs that have no automorphisms, then you might be able to ask questions like, you know, what's the minimum number of chains I need to uniquely describe all the events? And then maybe the answers to those questions could then be related to certain geometrical facts that you're deriving, like the dimensionality of the space and things like that.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you ever consider how hard putting this, like this axiom itself is? Because I think this question is NP-complete. Like you have to grasp determining whether they are isomorphic or not, which means whether they are in the same automorphism orbit or whatever is NP-complete. So determining whether a graph has a trivial automorphism set, let's say, might be super hard. I don't know how hard, maybe. NP hard as well.
No, that's interesting. Do you know what class it's in? The question, does this graph have a non-trivial automorphism? This is not an arbitrary graph, but it's obviously a similar question.
I don't know exactly, but for two general graphs, determining whether they are isomorphic is NP complete.
Right, so presume, but does it imply that the question for a fixed graph, does it have a non-trivial automorphism?
No.
Does that follow that that's NP complete too?
No, but the right way to pose a question in computational complexity is, given a graph, can you in general say, do you have a general algorithm that says whether it has a non-trivial automorphism?
Yes.
So you can't ask a question for a particular graph. So for a particular graph,
no,
you might be able to answer that.
Right. I mean, that means that there is an algorithm. The question is how
complex.
How slow,
it might run an exponential.
Yeah, it probably runs an exponential. So it would, I suppose. But oh, I was just curious, did you know for a fact that the question for an arbitrary graph, does it have non-trivial automorphism? Is that in the class of NP complete? Does anyone know?
I would assume it's the case, and it can be compared to the
better.
Other case, yeah. But,
I know that the number of graphs that have no automorphisms, no non-trivial automorphisms, scales exponentially with the number of nodes.
In some sense, I think most of them will have no non-trivial automorphisms. Is that what you're saying? It is true for posets. For poset, finite posets, that element, as n goes to infinity, the proportion which have a non-trivial automorphism goes to zero. That is known. The question to have an what's the best algorithm that will determine whether a given poset has a non-trivial automorphism? I don't know what's known. You're suggesting it might be NP complete. One last question. You said you thought about curve space or general algebra. Can you share some of the thoughts?
Well, actually, not really. We just we have the notion of mass related to the rates of being influenced, and that's all that we have until now. So it might be related to how at what rate, for example, an observer or a particle is being influenced. But not yet. We don't. That was the first thing that I first thought about. But it was like there are so many basic ideas that we had to derive first. We did not have anything. So that actually we just got busy with doing those, and general relativity is kind of pushed back.
Sorry, I take it back that it's NP complete. It's in NP, but it doesn't seem to be NP complete, but in some larger class than P. So in some intermediate case, it seems to be.
But it's smaller than NP. It's easier than NP complete.
No,
it might be
there are
worse.
Problems which are between P and NP complete.
I see. So it's not NP.
Yeah.
Oh, it's an easy problem.
It's like graph isomorphism. It's conceivable. It's the kind of problem that's conceivable. There could be a quantum algorithm that solves it in polynomial time.
Okay.
Oh, it's not for NP complete ones. There's no hope of them.
No, there's no hope. Just that if you look like factorization, which is an example, and you think, well, maybe quantum computers are good for those kinds of problems like factorization.
If there are no more questions, let's thank the speaker.
Thank you very much.